We have two cases set for oral argument. I am Dabney Basil. On my right is Justice Dana Womack, and on my left is Justice Brian Walker. Donna, would you go ahead and call our first case for us, please? Go ahead, sir.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Your Honors. Thank you for having me. If the court will give me a little latitude to kind of lay out an outline of kind of the facts under this case, I think it'll give you guys a little more insight to see how the law can apply to it. This case is a little different than your kind of average run-of-the-mill. I believe Mr. Daniel will agree. Your run-of-the-mill misdemeanor assault case in Denton County. The reason this one's different, it involves some immigration issues. It involves the Hindu Marriage Act, a family law hearing, and then the criminal case. They all arose out of the same set of facts. And so I would like to get into that a little bit to give you guys some kind of insight as to how we thought, or we think the law to be applied. My client, Niraj, was married to Shradra Sharma. Niraj Sharma married Shradra. Niraj, my client's the defendant. Shradra was the complaining witness in the assault family violence case. They were in an arranged marriage in India back in 2014. Early on in their marriage, Shradra claimed some family violence in India, which was investigated, and she claimed family violence in India to try to extract a dowry out of Niraj's family in India. This all came in the criminal trials, so it's all part of the record. And the police investigated in India, and the case was dismissed. There were no findings of family violence. Later, Niraj, and they stayed married. They separated for a while, but stayed married, and that's one of the issues we're going to talk about. Later, Niraj Sharma got a work visa to come to Dallas or Denton and work in the IT industry. And so his wife applied for a dependent visa to come here also. Now, the other thing that's important to know is that even though she had claimed family violence in India and there had been no finding of it, she still wanted to come here with Niraj because her sister lives here. Her sister's married. Her husband also has a work visa. She's very close to her sister, so she wanted to come to America also. So the only reason she was here was on a dependent visa based on Niraj's work visa. So they moved here in 2017. So the issues we're going to get into here in a little bit, and I think it's pretty clear, it's a fairly simple, straightforward case, and I've provided copies of both briefs if y'all have them, is the statements we're going to get into, are they prior bad acts under 608, which would otherwise most likely be inadmissible? Are they inconsistent statements under 613A, which could be admissible? Or are they statements to prove bias or motive under 613B, which would also be admissible? And the you will see there are three different times on the cross-examination of Shradra alone where we had to have send the jury out and have bench conferences with the judge over the issues of these statements. And my co-counsel, Mr. Sommier, who's seated back here to watch, he represented Shradra in the divorce case and then also cross-examined her in our criminal case. So if you've looked at the record, that's where Mr. Sommier's name comes into play. So these statements, which we're trying to get into, it's kind of, what are they? And Mr. Daniel correctly in his brief states that if they're prior bad acts, well, they're not admissible. And I think, I'll get into that in a minute. Let me go back. So knowing that Shradra is here on this dependent visa based on her husband's work visa, and she testifies that they don't get along, so she wants to be divorced from Niraj. Well, she can't divorce him and stay in the United States. The only way you can stay here as a citizen of another country, in India being one of them that has a lot of people come here for the IT industry, is to claim you're a victim of a violent crime. Family violence is one of those exceptions. If you claim you're a victim of family violence and you get a finding somewhere in a family court or criminal court, you can then get a green card and stay here. Shradra is very close to her sister and wanted to stay here. However, she did not want to be married to Niraj anymore. She had claimed family violence once in India, and it had been dismissed, no finding, never collected a dowry. So now that she's over here and wants to be here with her sister, she's got the opportunity to do this again. And this is the facts that we're operating under. When this case happened in February, the alleged offense took place on February 13th, a couple of years ago. Shradra talked to her sister daily and talked to her sister multiple times that day. The next day, talked to her again, or I think the sister came over that day and they talked and met. The next day they talked again. The sister is the one who called the police and said, "I believe my sister Shradra has been assaulted." So the police show up on February 14th, a day later. And as we get into the record, as the case gets filed and we see it, there are no injuries. The officers take pictures, there's body cam video. It was a delayed outcry by someone else. And so our belief and the theory that the defense was operating under when we went to this trial was that Shradra and her sister had concocted this story, hey, claim you're a victim of family violence and you can stay here.
And you were able to explore that theory at trial, weren't you? You were able to inquire about the
somewhat
process of obtaining a U visa.
Yes, somewhat. Mr. Samay got into that partially. We wanted to do more, and I'll get into that here in a second. But we were able to explore that theory on a limited basis, not as fully as we would like to have.
What part did the judge not allow you to get into?
The judge did not allow us to get into her. So as part of her U visa to get here, and she had to attach the Hindu Marriage Act document. And the Hindu Marriage Act document, which was signed when they got married and at some point before she came here, claims that they had been married continually and never separated. They have laws about not being separated and all that to apply. She had said that. On her direct examination, which is where this all kind of, the door gets kind of opened on this whole deal, on direct examination by the government, she said that she had separated from Niraj while in India for several months, which is directly contrary to what she had signed under oath.
Tell me where in the record that theory of admissibility was presented to the trial court.
We have three.
Where was the statement, "I separated from my husband"?
I've got it.
Contrary to states, to
it's on
exhibit number 12 of May.
It's on page 20 of our brief and pages 30 through 33 of the record, which is where she's on direct examination.
That's where she said it. Where was the theory that that was the prior inconsistent statement presented to the trial court?
Okay. So my co-counsel, Mr. Samier, on pages 121 through 124 of the transcript, this is the first time we were called out of the jury was sent out of the courtroom, and the judge acknowledges that Dennis Samier is trying to show her inconsistent statements, but sustains the government's objection to keep it out. That's pages 121 through 124.
And that was on the basis she said she was going to tell the truth.
No, sir, I don't believe that's correct. That was on a different issue. He was trying to cross-examine her on her sworn statement on the Hindu Marriage Act document. The place where she says she was going to tell the truth, Mr. Samay had asked her, "Do you always tell the truth?" He asked her that on cross, and she said, "I didn't to the police that day, but yes, I tell the truth." There was some issues on it, whether he was trying to impeach her on that also. But the basis was, while in family court, the Hindu Marriage Act document had come up, and she had testified in a deposition under oath, and in court at a temporary orders hearing, and third at another, there were three different times she testified about her signature on the Hindu Marriage Act document.
Why isn't that a collateral lie? Rather, it's inadmissible under 608.
It's a collateral issue, but she opened the door and brought it in, and that can be admitted.
She brought it in with the statement, "I separated from him."
Right, which was incorrect.
But that, counsel, I disagree with you that that theory was presented to the trial court.
Okay, well, we don't believe it was fully presented. You know, Aranda and other cases, Hammer, they allow great latitude in cross-examination on some of these things. She said on direct.
You didn't make a confrontation clause objection.
I didn't make a direct objection on that ground, but under, hang on, under Texas under Langston v. State, Texas Criminal Appeals, 1992, as regards to specificity, all a party has to do to avoid a forfeiture of a complaint on appeal is let the trial judge know what he wants, why he thinks he's entitled to it, and to do so clearly enough for the judge to understand him at the time the trial court's in a proper position to do something about it. You don't have to specifically say, I'm being denied confrontation. As long as it's clear.
You don't think the Rania case stands for that proposition?
That is another case, but the rules in Langston, Court of Criminal Appeals case, says as long as you're even, did you say the Aranda case?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, the Aranda case doesn't say you have to say that exactly.
Rania, R-E-Y-N-A.
Rania, doesn't, agreed. Rania also does not say you have to say that word specifically. All the rules require and the multitude of cases that were cited by Mr. Daniel and the girl in my office who wrote the brief was that you have to object with some type of specificity to let people know. It doesn't, you don't have to say the exact word motive, but if you're trying to say, hey, she's trying to get this because of that, that's motive, you're describing motive. There's no requirement that you have to say the word, I'm objecting under the Confrontation Clause. The rules just say with some specificity. And in addition, Texas Rules of, that was 33.1 that I was just referring to there. Under Texas Rules of Evidence, all that 103, all that's required is you timely object, you move to strike, you state a specific ground unless it was apparent from the context. What differentiates this case from just the regular run-of-the-mill cases we see where someone objects to one thing and you move on, we had three hearings under one cross-examination of one witness to discuss this issue. This was, you know, 30 minutes later, boom, the jury's out again. 30 minutes later, the jury's out again. And ad nauseum, and I can get them to go through this real quick, the three times we were out, so the court can see it. I want the court to be aware. It's on day two of the trial. Pages 121 through 124 of the transcript is when the jury went out the first time, and the judge and Mr. Sommier had a conversation, him trying to show her inconsistent statements. But the judge even acknowledges, is this inconsistent statement? He says, yes. She sustains the government's objection to keep it out, which I believe was the wrong ruling. 30 pages later, on pages 152 to 162 of the transcript, Dennis tries to bring her inconsistent statements in a different way. The judge says, I've already ruled on that. On page 157, Dennis tells the court he would like to make an offer of proof, which the court is mandated. They have to allow you to make an offer of proof. And that's in the rules. The judge confuses the issue and asks Dennis if he's trying to get into these statements as a prior bad act. Dennis says, inconsistent statements. The judge says, I've already ruled on that, and shut him down. So he tried to make an offer of proof twice. And again, he tried to make the second offer of proof on pages 166 through 170 of the transcript. And that's where he talks about motive, and the judge won't allow him to make an offer of proof. He
says in that statement, I'm not offering this for impeachment.
On one of them, but on two of the times he said, I'm not offering it for impeachment, but he did say I'm offering it for motive on the 166 through 170, and on the break before that, he says inconsistent statements twice. And the judge confused. She actually said inconsistent statements the first time. Then on the second break, the judge says, are you offering this for prior bad acts? And Dennis says, no, inconsistent statements. And she still sustained, I'm not going to let you go any further. So my feeling, and I know Judge Peel, she's an excellent judge, my feeling is this trial was very rushed. We had three different breaks to try to get into this issue of where Shradra had committed perjury. It's very relevant to her motive to lie in this case, and we weren't allowed to explore that.
You were allowed to explore that.
Partially. If the jury was not apprised of her sworn statements, the three different times she had said how her signature got on this Hindu marriage document, saying that she'd never been separated. And she'd been deposed, she'd testified in trial, and the jury did not get a clear indication of that. What the jury got was they had been married, they had been separated, yes, she's here on a dependent visa, and yes, she can stay here as a victim of family violence. What they did not get an impression of was that she had a motive to create this false narrative of being a victim of assault. And when you look at the, and I've included in my brief, if you look at the fact that There's really no evidence of injuries. Her sister says there were some bruising. The officers produced some pictures which don't really show any bruising. One of the officers said, oh, it looks like a bruise until we crossed him. He said it's a shadow on her leg that looks like the shadow on the other leg. One of the officers on redirect after we crossed him, the government brought him back to, well, I think I did see her limping. The second officer refused to corroborate that. We introduced the body cam video. The DA didn't. In the body cam video, there's the officer following around the house, and she's not limping. They're there interviewing her and interviewing Naraj, and there's no real injuries seen. And again, it goes back to there had been 24 hours between when this alleged incident happened and when the sister called the police. And the motive is for Shradra to be able to stay in America and be close to her sister and raise her kids here with her sister. And she couldn't do that if she simply wanted to divorce Naraj. She had to have a plan, and the plan involved, they didn't have a great marriage, so the plan involved concocting, potentially, this assault story.
Thank you, sir.
Okay.
Go ahead.
May it please the court. My name is Rick Daniel. I represent the state in this matter. I would like to start by going over exactly what was excluded and then the discussions between trial counsel and the court on the reasons why the evidence should have been admitted and then the court's rulings. And then from there, go into the preservation of error or lack of. In regards to the items that were excluded, there were three things that were excluded. Started with a question about them getting married under the Hindu Marriage Act. There was an objection to relevance. Then there was a discussion. The court asked defense counsel, what is the relevance of this line of questioning? Defense counsel said that I have evidence that this document, the Hindu Marriage Act, had her signature on it. There was a divorce proceeding where she testified inconsistently with that she said that she didn't sign it, she signed it under duress. And then after this discussion, the court, and I'm going to quote what the court said, okay, I guess, do you want to ask her about whether they were registered under the Hindu Marriage Act so you can ask her about this signature thing because you have evidence that she has been inconsistent about that in a prior proceeding? Not this proceeding, but a prior proceeding. To which defense counsel responded, yes, Your Honor. The trial court then sustained the objection. So in that first area, there's no mention of the confrontation clause. There's no mention of the words bias, motive, or interest. There's no mention of the number 613, either A or B. There's no mention of creating a false impression. And there's no identification of an inconsistent statement in this trial to anything in that document. Defense counsel argued to the court that you don't have to use the exact language of confrontation clause. I disagree. I think Reyna pretty much says that you're not going to be able to just make a credibility, trustworthy, any type of objection like that, because the court won't know whether you're doing confrontation clause or the rules of evidence. So whenever that comes up in that particular case, you're going to have to use those magic words of confrontation clause. I think that Reyna says that, and this court has ruled consistently with that. A good case is Riddle back in 2017 by this court, and a recent case is Brown a couple of months ago. That simply, you know, arguing, even if you argued bias, motive, and interest, I think that Riddle is the case where that was insufficient. They argued trustworthiness, and then they had the bias, modus of interest that would, you know, you would think might invoke the confrontation clause, but you have to clarify, I'm talking about the confrontation clause. So in that area, I think you do have to use the magic words. So I don't think confrontation clause was preserved at all, which will also affect the back end, because appellant on his harm analysis used the Van Alsdahl factors that would apply if a confrontation clause violation had occurred. Then it would be under the constitutional violation, you'd use those factors. Under this fact situation, if anything was preserved, it wasn't the confrontation clause, so we'd ultimately be dealing on the harm analysis with 44.2B, non-constitutional. Under, I think, a recent case out of this court is Ryan POTUS, P-O-Y-D-A-S, recognized that when we're dealing with situations like this, you're going to use 44.2B.
I assume in some of these cases, not before you get to the harm analysis, but when we're talking about being precise with bringing up confrontation clause, that some of them are a situation where counsel objects under hearsay, but they didn't object under the confrontation clause. Is that some of the cases that you've come across?
The ones that I've cited were not necessarily hearsay. They would be arguing why it would be admissible, similar situations to what we're dealing with, why this is admissible, and they would say it's admissible for credibility, to attack the credibility. It's admissible to attack trustworthiness. It's admissible to show biased motive or interest. That's the significant cases, Riddle, where they went so far as to say, I'm objecting under that it's attacking trustworthiness, and I'm also objecting under biased motive and interest. And this court said that's not going to be sufficient because you've got to identify to the court whether you're going with the confrontation clause or just going with the regular Texas rules of evidence. So none of those areas were preserved on that first area. And defense counsel, in his brief, references opening the door, a false statement, and there is a statement made by defense counsel about she testified on oath that she never lies. That testimony...
And she immediately said she lied to the police.
Yes, and then she said she lied to the police. And plus, that was not obviously brought up to the trial court as a basis for getting into evidence. And second, it was on cross-examination, and you can't open your own doors. You can't create your false impression and then go into an impeachment. The cases on that, I don't have it in my brief, but Court of Criminal Appeals case Lopez, 928 Southwest 2nd, 528 at 531, is a good case that you can't prompt or maneuver somebody into creating a false impression just so you can impeach them. It's like the state, you know, asking, have you ever been in trouble with the law, and a defendant saying no, and you just throw in all these unadjudicated offense. You can't do it. You can't be the one that prompts or motive or maneuvers into the false impression. So even if it was preserved, it wouldn't apply. And also in the brief, the defense counsel brought up the statement of she said on direct that they'd been separated. And then the Marriage Act says that they'd never been separated. That would be a prior inconsistent statement that could be a basis for that coming in that would be an exception to 608B, but it was never brought up to the trial court. I mean, if the trial court, if they would have said, hey, we want to impeach this one statement she said, you know, that she said that they had been separated, and this shows that they were never separated, their prior inconsistent statement, we want to get into that, the trial court probably would have let it. They would have probably looked at whether it was collateral or not collateral and whether it's a proper impeachment, but it was never brought up to the trial court that was a reason for it. The reason brought up was we have this statement over here, the Marriage Act document, that is inconsistent with this statement over here, her statements at divorce, which is 608B. That's exactly why we have the rule 608B, and that's a great example of 608B, of specific acts that are used to attack credibility. If it was a statement in court in a trial proceeding, it'd be a 613A inconsistent statement, but when you have inconsistent statements out of court, you're looking at 608B. So that first area, that error was not preserved in any of those categories. And the only basis was 608B. So the trial court didn't err in excluding that. The second one is then there was an attempt to offer the actual Marriage Act document. Then the court, the relevance of this document that you have is evidence of inconsistency with the witness, whether she signed it or didn't sign it. Am I saying that right? That is the relevance of this document. Response, yes. Statements under oath, yes. So you're offering this. The relevance is specific prior bad acts of this witness. Response, yes. Inconsistent testimony, yes. It's them offering it for the purpose of showing she said something on Monday as A and on Tuesday as B, a prior inconsistent statements that were outside of court. That's 608B. The basis for offering it that they were arguing is exactly 608B. Again, no confrontation clause, no mention of the word motive, no mention of the word bias, no mention of the word interest. No mention of 613A, no mention of 613B, no opening the door, no identifying of a prior inconsistent statement. Those are the first two. The third one that was excluded was the application for extension of immigration. And in that document contained the Marriage Act document. And the court, when it was offered, the court pointed that out. This contains that same document that I just held was inadmissible. And in response, the trial counsel said, we're not offering this for impeachment. It is proof of marriage. And the court noted that, well, you've already questioned her on her marriage and her immigration status and all of those things. And so she sustained the objection because it can't contain that previously inadmissible document, and there was no basis to go back into their marriage and immigration status. It's already been covered on direct and already been crossed. So none of the areas, any of the three areas, was there any confrontation clause, any bias, motive, or interest, any of the things alleged in the appellant's brief presented to the trial court. So trial counsel's arguments do not comport with appellant's brief, and all of the arguments in appellant's brief, none of them were preserved. But even assuming that they were preserved, there would be no violation of the confrontation clause. A good case on that would be actually a case cited in appellant's brief, Reyes. In Reyes, they raised and objected to a false allegation outside of court under the confrontation clause. And they properly preserved error and they argued it. But the only thing they had was that these were a lie outside of court. There was no evidence of a bias or motive or interest that would take it outside of 608B. That's different than, let's say, Billaboo is a Court of Criminal Appeals case, and Hammer is another Court of Criminal Appeals case. Those are two cases where you have sexual assault cases where the victim had made an out-of-court statement that was a false allegation. There was evidence presented that the allegation was false, and it would be something that would violate 608B, but in that case, they also had tied to that it was evidence of motive. So it would be admissible under the confrontation clause of motive, despite the fact that it violated 608B. In particular, in Billaboo, there was an allegation made against a defendant who had taken away a child's toy. The child got upset. After getting upset, made the allegation. He was angry at the time. And then later, after that, he got angry at some neighbors and threatened to make false allegations against the neighbors. The neighbors were at court, prepared to testify. He got mad, threatened to make the false allegations. That would be normally a 608B violation, but because it goes to motive, separate from 608B, it would be admissible in the confrontation clause. We don't have any of that. What we have is similar to Reyes. I think in Reyes, the defendant pled guilty to an assault. And then on cross-examination, he goes, were you guilty of the assault or not guilty of the assault? And he said, I acted in self-defense. This is outside the presence of the court, outside the presence of the jury. But the defendant testified, well, actually, I was acting in self-defense. And so the defense wanted to argue and ask him on, you know, in front of the jury that he lied to the judge. A statement out of court, because he said, A, I'm guilty, and B, I acted in self-defense. They're inconsistent. So he wants to present that in front of the jury and argued that the confrontation clause allows it. The court said, no, that's not bias, motive, or interest. That's just strictly over here at violating 608B. There are ways to impeach, you know, if you have those out-of-court statements, you can go under 608A where you ask, do you have an opinion about whether they're honest or truthful? You know, that's our mechanism for getting that evidence in, informative opinion, but the rule specifically excludes or prohibits specific instances of conduct. So it's not going to be a violation of confrontation clause. 613B is pretty much in lockstep with confrontation clause in regards to bias, motive, and interest, and there's simply none in this. There's nothing presented. There's nothing that shows a signature on a document that is inconsistent with divorce testimony has anything to do with any bias, motive, or interest. So we're left with 613A, a prior inconsistent statement. And the inconsistent statement isn't a statement made in trial. There's no statement identified in trial other than what I talked about a minute ago where she testified on direct that they'd been separated and the Marriage Act document shows that they'd been married. which was never presented to the court. Other than that, there's no statement at trial that's inconsistent, that was demonstrated to, okay, we have this document, or we have this evidence, or we have anything that can show a prior inconsistent statement. And I've already addressed opening the door. None of, even if error was preserved, this is straight up a 608B violation. It's none of the things alleged in the appellate's brief.
But before you move on, so if the defendant had specifically said, is it true that you had signed this document and said these things, and then she said, that's not true, then at that point, they could have asked a follow-up question to try to impeach her, because it's inconsistent with what they know is to be true, correct? I mean, if she had made a statement in trial that they knew was not true, then they could have gotten into the prior inconsistent statement.
Then you would go into a discussion of whether it's collateral impeachment or not, but assuming it's not collateral impeachment, then yes. If she made the statement, I never signed the Marriage Act document during this trial, and then you have this document that shows her signature, that's a 613A prior inconsistent statement that you could then offer into evidence, and that would be something that the trial court would then determine, okay, well, is this a collateral or not collateral? And, you know, kind of could go both ways on this. This one is such a minor detail. It might be an issue that would be improper to impeach on because it's a collateral matter, because it's just a signature of a document 10 years ago. It doesn't really relate to anything. All of the immigration, marriage, separation, all of that was developed. There's no issue at dispute that this document and the statement of signing it or not signing it is going to, you know, make more or less probative. So it probably would be a collateral matter, but it didn't happen.
It didn't happen that way.
It didn't happen that way. But if it did, then you would go through that analysis, yes.
And as to preservation, did the judge ever specifically say, I am not going to allow you to make an offer of proof?
No, it just got dropped off. There was discussion about it, and then, which is another thing I failed to point out, there was never any questioning outside the jury of Ms. Sharma. I mean, they could have asked, may I take the witness on voir dire outside the presence of the jury and develop a record, and then you would at least have potential for something, preservation, but there was no questions or no calling witnesses that were present at the divorce or anything. I mean, there was just...
Or during a break.
Yeah, and there was nothing presented of evidence other than statements of counsel that this is inconsistent, this was perjury, there was nobody testifying to those things, which kind of ties into another point that's in my brief, but concerning establishing that the statement is actually false. There's nothing in the record. The case on that would be Tinlin, out of this court, where you actually have to show, you have to have evidence that it's false. You know, if you're going to go under the motive, bias, interest, and kind of that route and confrontation, you have to show that it's false. And there was no evidence other than counsel's statements that the actual statements were false. So, in regards to, you know, the 613A, 613B, opening the door, all of this, you know, I've addressed and wasn't preserved, and even if it was preserved, it's not this case. This case is straight up a 608B violation, and that was what they were trying to do, was to offer it as something that 608B prohibits. We would ask the court to affirm the judgment. Thank you.
Thank you.
I saw you nodding your head.
I didn't mean to do that.
Where did the...
I tell my clients not to do that.
No, that's fine. At what point did the judge specifically say that you could not make an offer of proof?
On page 159 of the record, that was our second time to be outside the presence of the jury. The court and Mr. Sommier are having a discussion about him wanting to impeach her over this document, these statements. At the bottom of that page, it says, so are you offering this as a specific prior bad act? And Dennis says, inconsistent testimony. The court does, and the state have an objection. They object. Then the judge sustains the relevance objection, and Dennis asks if he can ask her about if she's perjured herself on the document, and Judge says, I've already ruled on that. And on the next page, on page 160, Dennis is asking, can he impeach her, given her inconsistent testimony? The judge responds, I'm sustaining the state's objection on the line of questioning that we discussed earlier. Mr. Sommier then says, I would like to make an offer of proof as Defense Exhibit 12, Your Honor. Court says, it's been offered, so it's going to be on the record. She did that twice. We had three different hearings outside the presence of the jury, and it was a very rushed trial. I don't know why, but it moved quickly, and to have three different outside the jury sessions during the cross-examination of one witness, it was a big deal, and everybody knew what was going on. The DA was fighting to keep it out, and the judge was moving us quickly, but Dennis twice tried to make an offer of proof, and the judge said no. It's been offered.
She let him make the offer of proof in the form of Defense Exhibit 12, and he didn't say, I want to offer anything else.
But when we get to this other part, she doesn't let him go into what he would ask her and what
did
she would
ask
say.
Did he ask her to go into anything else?
No, but he said, I'd like to make an offer of proof. She says, it's been offered. And so Mr. Daniel correctly states that in the record there is no evidence of the inconsistent statements that we could use to impeach her. But at the beginning of the trial, there was a motion in limine. And the judge had ruled that before we got into any of the divorce stuff or any of those kinds of things, we would approach. So he was not allowed on cross-examination to just kind of just start asking her, hey, have you done this? Have you signed this? Did you make this statement? Did you depose on this? We had to approach. And so as we approach is when all these conversations took place. So there was so he correctly states there's nothing on the record to show the inconsistent statements, but because we were told in motion in limine to approach, and we would approach and you'd get these conversations at the bench. So we were never allowed to lay the predicate.
The focus of this is Defense Exhibit 12, and defense counsel says this is the document that she testified. I didn't sign it. It's a forgery. And then she changed it to, I signed it under duress. And then she changed it to, yes, that's my signature. I signed it.
This was outside the presence of the jury.
I understand that, but that's the basis for why he wanted it in, to impeach her on the fact that she'd lied about this document.
That's one of many. But yes, we weren't allowed to ask those questions in front of the jury. This was all outside the presence.
Because the judge felt like that was a specific act of dishonesty that's not admissible. It's not admissible under 608.
But under 613 it is. And so when she testified on direct that she'd been separated, and these documents in the divorce hearing she testified that she hadn't been, that's what makes this collateral matter relevant, as some of the cases have said, is, yeah, collateral matters, generally you cannot do that. But if they open the door, or if it's relevant to this, then you can. And the court has wide discretion to allow that to happen.
And has wide discretion not to allow it to happen.
I understand. I would argue differently. I would argue that the Sixth Amendment and the case law says that we're allowed to kind of vigorous cross-examination. And this was a case where she had perjured herself. So we believe we should have been able to get into it. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you all. We appreciate your arguments very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Sweeney, your co-counsel is not here yet, is he?
He is. He's in the lobby.
Okay. We'll give you all, if you all are ready to go, we'll be back out here in 5 minutes, ready to hear your case.
Alerting.
Thank you, sir. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.